Welcome to podcast number 87 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is February 4th, 2020, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. My guest today is Andrew Welsh Huggins. By day, Andrew is an editor and reporter for the Associated Press in Columbus, Ohio, focusing on criminal justice issues. He's also the author of six mysteries featuring Andy Hayes, a former Ohio State and Cleveland Browns quarterback turned private eye. Of Andrew's most recent book, Fatal Judgment, Publishers Weekly said, "Intriguing. Fans of Robert B. Parker's Jesse Stone books will be pleased." Andrew is also the editor of Columbus Noir Anthology, upcoming in March from Akasic Books. His 2009 nonfiction book, No Winners Here Tonight, is the definitive history of the death penalty in Ohio. His short story, Mystery Fiction, has appeared in Kings River Life, Down and Out Magazine, Mystery Weekly Magazine, and Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. When he's not writing or reporting, Andrew enjoys running, reading, and spending time with his family. My pleasure to bring Andrew Welsh Huggins to the podcast. Welcome to My Favorite Detective Stories. My Favorite Detective Stories features successful private investigators. They offer insights into their careers and advice to those just starting out or to those who are struggling. You will learn from the best. Of course, we cannot finish the show without asking them to share their favorite detective story. On alternating weeks, you will hear from crime fiction writers who discuss their latest books and what makes their fictional detectives tick. Throughout my investigative career spanning five decades, I cannot think of a time that I didn't have a good crime novel on my coffee table or bedstand. We will also talk about their favorite authors as well. As a working investigator, coach, and writer, I hope to bring inspiration, information, and entertainment in the areas that interest me most. Gather around my campfire as I invite you to listen in. This episode is brought to you by my own crime thriller with a mystery twist, Odessa on the Delaware. A Russian gang enforcer is on a murderous rampage to take over the entire Philadelphia mob scene. A homeless vet doesn't know that he has the proof or that he's next on the list. The stakes are high for this deadly cat-and-mouse game set on the bleak Philly waterfront of years gone by. FBI agent Marcia O'Shea, a gunslinger from the Miami cartel days, is back in her hometown, quietly finishing out her career, but now is drawn into this case with a secret pushing her doggedly to follow the clues, only to uncover a greater secret that may get her killed in the final showdown. You can buy Odessa from your favorite online retailer. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the show.
Hey. Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Say, so how's the weather out there in Columbus, Ohio these days?
Well, we are probably giving up hopes for a white Christmas other than a little bit that we have on the ground. It's pretty mild, probably in the 50s, and it's going to be that way. So pleasant for this time of year, but I'm a person who doesn't mind a little cold. Grew up in New York State in the 70s when it was like looked like the Antarctic, but we won't be getting that this year. But,
okay.
You know, it's all good.
What part of New York State, can I ask?
I grew up in the Finger Lakes, a little town called Lima, about 20 miles south of Rochester.
Okay. I'm not familiar with it. Heard its name before, but you also get a lot of snow lake effect down there and not much to stop the Arctic blast coming out of Canada, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, we would get pounded. My story is that everyone is familiar with the Blizzard of 78.
Oh, yeah.
Which was the so my story on that is I don't really remember the Blizzard of 78. Because we had so many blizzards in the 70s, there was so much snow that it all just sort of blended together.
Mm. So you don't mind it?
No, no. To this day, I like a snowstorm.
As we speak today, it's December 21st, Saturday recording for us. And it's just a cold, raw day here in Milford, Connecticut. We got above freezing like for about an hour. And that was it. And now, of course, I think it is the longest or the shortest day of the year or the longest night of the year, depending on which way you look at it. And our solstice begins. So anyhow, I'm glad I reached out to you because I think we talked briefly once before and you had showed an interest in coming on podcast. And I was really interested in your writings, particularly with your writings in the books involving Andy Hayes, your fictional PI. You just want to kind of tell me how that all came to be in the beginning and what and how Andy has changed over the books. And I don't mind. Tell me book by book and let's just go through them.
Yeah, happy to. I'm just going to go back a little bit and say that Andy Hayes was the character that I always wanted to write, but it took me about 30 years to get there. You know, I grew up loving mysteries, even as a little kid. At 8 years old, I was pulling my mom's Perry Mason paperbacks off the top shelf and reading them, and maybe understanding about half of it, but that really drew me into it. And I knew early on
Earl Stanley Gardner.
Earl Stanley Gardner. That's right.
Yeah.
The titles like The Case of the Velvety Claw and Case of the Daring Divorcee. And fortunately, these you know, these books are from 40s, 50s, very clean by standards now. So nothing in the world been followed by.
Mm.
In fact, I still have some of those falling apart, but I just love to open them up and read those.
He was the J.K. Rowling of time in paperback.
Yeah, just he would work until he really made it big. He would work all day as a defense attorney. He was a practicing lawyer. He'd work all day, come home, look up stuff for his cases, and then late at night would sit there and he would pound out 4,000 words, and not go to bed till he had that done.
Mm.
So, you know, just kind of inspirational from a work.
Oh God, yeah. Think about 4,000 words on a manual typewriter.
Exactly. Yeah. We take a lot for granted.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Question
for sure. So anyway, I digressed a little bit, but you thank you for telling me about one of your earlier influences. So from that time until you got to Andy, what was the journey like?
Well, I always, you know, I knew that I was always attracted to the private eye, and my other than having sort of a sort of knowledge of people like Raymond Chin, Ross McDonald, Heschel Hammond, I had read a little bit of those guys and some probably short stories. I actually didn't really read a lot of their novels until later. But you know, what really got me going, probably two authors, Robert B. Parker and his Spencer series.
Right.
My wife and I, we lived in Providence, Rhode Island, and went to Boston a lot. And that's when his series, I thought, was just at its height. Some of those novels were just so outstanding. And I just kind of absorbed those. Somewhat around the same time, I started reading Lauren Esselman, who's Amos Walker series set in Detroit. In fact, he has a new Amos Walker that just came out. Someplace in there, obviously, across Sue Graff, Kinsey Mahone. So I knew, even though I love all kinds of mysteries and procedurals, and I've always been attracted that private eye, especially told in first person. So I knew that's when I wanted to write a series, that's what I'd get around to. But it sort of took me a while to get there. Was just, you know, working as a full-time journalist. We had little kids, but also we moved quite a lot. And I always say that it wasn't until we moved to Columbus, 1998, burned all our moving boxes, that I realized I had found the city that was the place I was going to live, and also a place I really began to grow to like and appreciate, and felt at the time there was really not any kind of private owner, and it always puzzled me. And so it sort of took me moving here and living here for a while to realize, oh, this is the place where I want to set the series. So that was the beginning. But of course, then I was, you know, what character do I want? So I knew I wanted a private eye, and you know, I knew it was going to be a guy. I didn't have the confidence, you know, at that point to sort of create a female character.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, okay, who is this guy going to be? And more importantly, you know, what's his backstory? What's his, he's a wounded warrior, a fallen angel. What's that going to be? So I thought, I thought about making him a veteran. Some of the best PIs out there, and detectives out there have a wartime experience, but I just felt like I would not bring authenticity to that. I'm not a veteran myself, and although I know I could do a lot of research on it, so I started looking around. And it's sort of funny that, you know, here I am in Columbus. I'm not a big football fan, but football, especially college football, dominates this town.
Oh, on Saturdays it's ghost town unless you're at the stadium.
Exactly, and. One story I tell that leads to the creation of I moved here in 90. That year, Ohio State was busily marching its way to the national championship. They were undefeated until a game in late October when they played Michigan State, not Michigan, but Michigan mm-hmm. State, and they lost. And I remember thinking, you know, well, that's too bad. And then I got up the next morning and started reading the coverage and looking around, and it was sort of as if the entire town was attending a funeral, but they were also mad at the person who died. And I realized that was a moment where the enormity of Ohio State football impact struck. And so a number of years later, I had written a couple of nonfiction books based on my journalism, but I was sort of ready to launch into fiction. And that's when it sort of hit me, like, of course, what better backstory for a guy in this town to have been, you know, at the top of his game, literally, Ohio State quarterback, you know, the closest thing we have to a god on it. But then to have him fall from grace to Andy's case, he leading the Buckeyes to the national championship his senior year. But then the week before the Michigan game, he gets himself arrested. They lose the game. They're not national champions. He becomes persona non grata. And this is a stain on his character that will follow him for the rest of his career and his life. And he's a true cad in those days. Anyways, at one point in the book Slow Burn, somebody asks him about his college experiences. He replies, well, I majored in girls and I minored in trouble. And that sort of defines him until he eventually hits rock bottom after a short, rocky tenure with the Cleveland Browns, and eventually clears his head, realizes that one thing he's good at is taking a few knocks to the head and getting back up again. He does some investigative work for a defense attorney, does pretty well at it, eventually hangs out his own shingle and becomes a private eye in Columbus.
That's a great backstory. And so there's people there that, on one hand, he has name recognition, but then they want to spit on the sidewalk at the same time.
Exactly right. I've played with this a lot over the years. I mean, that's very much a theme. First book, Fourth Down and Out. In fact, there's a culminating scene where he actually, there's a reason he has to go into Ohio Stadium where he has not been since his college days. And, you know, people are swearing at him, throwing, you know, well, there wasn't beer in those days, but, you know, they're throwing soda bottles at him, mm-hmm. mustard, and it's just, and he just sets his face into a determined grimace and marches up the stairs to do what he has to do. Since then, the one cool thing about Columbus is, you know, we're a growing city. We're actually one of the only big growing cities in the West. And we're on track to add like a million people by 2050.
Wow.
And so I've had to recognize that, you know, not everybody is going to see him and say, oh, you're the dirty scoundrel that ruined my college days by blowing the game. Sort of like Columbus itself, he's maturing. His sports background still comes into the books a lot. Part of his journey is both to rise above what he did, but also to come to terms with the fact that despite that horrible thing he did, he actually was quite a good athlete. And sort of complicate his life is he has two sons by two different ex-wives, and his older son is now up in high school, and you know, lo and behold, is a pretty good quarterback. Not as good as dad, but he's pretty good. And so that's something that Andy is having to grapple with, that he has this complicated history with the sport, but he also wants to be a supportive dad. But of course, his son also has to deal with the fact that every time he reads a paper, there's a reference to him, the son of this guy who ruined everything. So
yeah. Oh, gosh.
That's all part of Andy's extremely complicated.
That's great. Love that. And through his flaws and through his backstory, he has to swim a little harder upstream. And I think that makes him a little bit more of an interesting detective than the ex-army guy that might have, you know, a black belt training or a ranger training, can rappel out of helicopters and know how to fire every type of automatic weapon imaginable, drive every piece of heavy equipment ever known to man, you know? And I think that's kind of neat that you got a guy there that is faced with his past and trying to reconcile that and trying to still make something worthwhile out of his life. Now, yeah, was the last name Hayes a homage to Woody?
It was.
Very much so. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, I do not recommend your same name, first name.
Right.
But my defense on this is that when I was coming up with this character, the name just came to me one day. And I knew at that moment that was him. There was no question. And the reason for that is, first of all, as you correctly identified, his last name is Hayes. So all through his high school and college days, his nickname is Woody. It was a natural for people to call him Woody because of the real life, very, very famous Ohio State football coach, Woody Hayes. The reason he goes by Andy is, I'll be honest, in many ways, he's my alter.
Nothing wrong with that.
No one, but you know, no one calls me Andy and no one calls him Andrew.
Okay.
And, except his mother when she's mad at him.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I thought about in hindsight, I thought about other names, but then I just realized now that's this guy's name. So that's who he is.
No, I understand completely.
Yeah. He's named and people, there are a couple of the peripheral characters in his life who, are allowed to call him Woody. Kind of out of a sense of irony. He works a lot with a bail bondsman. And he's allowed to call him Woody. There's a couple other people, but when people who aren't in this very small circle call him Woody, that immediately kind of gets his hackles up and he has to correct them. They don't want to be corrected. That's a whole other part of the tension.
And that's nice. That's another piece of tension and it works and you made something out of it. I know where you're coming from. I'm John. And only to three people that are living can call me Johnny. And that's my sister, my brother, and my father. My mom's passed. But the idea is that, no, I'm John and not Johnny. And I just know where you come from with the Andrew and the Andy. So that was nice. You helped me with that. So how does Andy grow from being the hated and vilified quarterback and, I guess, fall down at Cleveland Browns, you know, to where he's now in most recent books. So just kind of walk me through.
Sure. Yeah. I don't want to say that he was a flat out caricature in the first couple of books, but like I said, that I probably highlighted these, this situation of his. And I think, to be honest, one of the ways he's probably grown the most, and I think the books are grown, I'm particularly proud of, is that, especially in the most recent book, Fatal Judgment, one that was coming, 2021, is he really is striving in his personal life to be the man and the dad that he wasn't as a younger person.
Mm.
And, that's a big deal.
To have that sort of recognition, especially after having all that fame and I want to use the word idolization thrown at him, because you know, like you said, these guys are like gods. And now he's fallen from Olympus.
Yeah. And that's, you know, people have told me they like the fact, well, a lot of people tell me they like the fact that he has a dog and it's realistic, like that sometimes in the middle of a case, he has to bang dog out.
Mm-hmm.
But people have also said, you know, he has two sons and he has partial custody based on the fact that, you know, early on he had to fight for any custody and now, but he does see his sons a lot and they, he has to sometimes work his cases around them. And, you know, I borrowed a little bit of that from, the Cleveland writer, Les Roberts, who, wrote, a wonderful series about a private eye named Milan Yakovich. And those were all set in Cleveland. Also very influential and I really appreciate those books. And in those books, Milan Yakovich has a son that his ex has, and he doesn't see a lot of, or not as much as he'd like to. Mm. And especially in the book I just finished called Empty Grave, he really has to. He's dealing with some stuff with his sons, even as he's getting involved in this very dangerous situation. Sort of to answer your question, I think he's really grown as a father, and he's doing a better job getting along it's one of his ex-wives. He's also trying to reconcile himself with his father, who he's had a very rocky relationship quite a while. And in a couple of the more recent books, you know, there's some scenes with his father where they tone things down a little bit. The other thing Andy is always trying to do a better job at is work on his romantic life. And he does this in context of having been, just the worst kind of husband, you know, philanderer, had tons of girlfriends, if you call that, college, and was a pro ball player. And now he's become sort of what I call a serial monogamist. He does his best to have grown-up relationships with women. They often don't last long, not because I think he treats them badly, but because, he's a person now who devotes himself to his boys and also to his cases. And he gets this sort of fever will possess him when he's on a case. And it's good for solving crime, but not very good for
going out romance. To the show on Friday night. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Right. And his girlfriends get a little tired of that. So that's always a struggle for him. I hope I did that maturely. I'm very sensitive to him not being a skirt chaser. And although this might sound a little bit silly, women that Andy gets involved with are age appropriate. I don't think anybody's interested in a detective who's now probably in his early to mid 40s. That old trope of him chasing a 22-year-old or a 22-year-old actually interested in a guy like that. I mean, that's just like silly.
No Ingrid Bergman's in there.
Exactly. No, yeah. Perfect analogy. So that's, I try to pay close attention to that. And I also try to work on him, trying to have actual grown-up platonic relationships with so that the goal is that the characters are grown-ups.
And that's interesting that you can find some time in the novels to explore a private eye having a platonic relationship with a person of the other sex. It just seems so outside of the trope, you know, if you think about it. Oh my God, how many, like if they're not racing against the clock to do this, or if they're not, they're just trying to recover from some beating that they've taken, to be able to then in some scene have them in discussion with another person where maybe it's forwarding the plot, but it doesn't. It's not central to it. That's cool that you can do that and make it work. That is really nice.
That's the goal, anyway.
Yeah. No, that's neat because you are going against trope with that, and that's nice. Yeah, I like it. So, 6 books now, going on 7.
Yeah. So, the first 6 books came out. I have an anthology of short stories coming out in March, and just in terms of timing and for some other reasons, the next Andy Hayes book will not come out until spring of 2021. But we're on board to continue that series. Mm-hmm. And I also have a couple of short stories going with Andy. In fact, the first one is out in Ellery Queen History Magazine this month, where it's a short story set around Christmas time and Andy searches for a missing husband. And I've got a couple other, got another Andy Hayes short story coming out
nice.
Next year. So,
Ellery Queen has been around for years and it still is one of the best places for shorts, honest to God. I had a chance this past January, February, and a little bit of March to read as a judge for the Seamus Awards, the short story category. Mm-hmm. So I had all these Ellery Queen issues showing up on my doorstep in brown paper bags. My wife thought I was like secret porn. No, honey, it's all mystery stuff. No, it's coming from publishers, legitimate publishers. So anyway, but yeah, really nice stuff. I'm glad to hear that, you're active in that. And that's still a viable medium for getting good quality short stories out there. And I loved it. I loved being the judge. I read 45 short stories during a course of a 3-month period. And every night I had to sit down with a couple, it's not like I guess I wanted to, you know what I mean? I'm a judge, and I'm looking at pile getting higher, and I'm saying, well, I better get through them. And I just loved it. I just loved it, and I loved the chance to see different writers flex their muscles in the short story venue, which I think, I don't know about you, but I find it to be much harder to write a short story than a 75,000-word novel. Honest to God, I really do.
It's a good discipline. You know, I will say, just as a side note, I've been, not that I'm any huge expert on this, but I'm very impressed with the amount of short mystery fiction that's out there. And frankly, the number of outlets that are publishing it. Now, you're not going to get rich writing for these magazines, but there are quite a number that do pay. You know, I'll put a little shout out for the Short Mystery Fiction Society, which has been very helpful to me. And it's a great organization to join, because that's a place where you can learn, you know, obviously you learn about short fiction markets, but it's also just a great place to where people interact talking about mysteries in general. So I didn't actually anticipate writing short stories when I first started my first Andy Hayes novel, but I now write a lot of short stories, you know, when I'm not working on the books, and I really like the discipline. I like the shorter form. You're right. It's a real challenge to, especially hit like a word limit. I like that discipline of, this particular magazine, you can only write 5,000 words, and that's hard and fast. Do not submit it if it's 5,001. And the challenge of cutting is very good.
Learn to use hyphens.
Well put.
Yeah. So I'm really happy to hear this. And you have, and you also did a nice nonfiction that I would be interested in hearing a little bit more about. And that was regarding the death penalty in Ohio.
Yeah. So, I'm a reporter for the Associated Press.
Right.
Back in around the 2000, Ohio's death penalty law was about, it was just about to turn 20. We started to hear some calls for people, from people saying, you know, it's two decades in, is this law really working? Doing what lawmakers have been doing? And you know, no one in state government wanted to touch this. And so I took this on as a reporter, and sort of long story short, it took me 3 years, but I analyzed every single capital punishment case from 1901 to 2002, figured out what happened to every defendant, figured out the race of every defendant, the race of every victim, how the case was resolved, whether it actually was a death sentence, whether it was a plea bargain, whether it was dismissed, a lot of data crunching. And I published a series of stories in 2005 that basically showed what's been found about the death penalty pretty much everywhere, that it's very, it's implemented very unevenly in Ohio, at least it used to. And so, you know, you would have just horrific murders, multiple murders, you know, someone killing four or five people, and they would be allowed to take a plea bargain. And then in the next county over, you would have a sort of a stop and rob convenience store thing that went south, and the clerk killed, and that person gets the death penalty. Well, once those stories came out and I did follow-up reporting, I decided, you know, I'm going to try to turn this into a book. It's not quite as easy as I thought it was going to be, but very happy to that project accepted. And it took me about almost 4 years to bring that to fruition. But that No Winners Here Tonight came out in 2009. And, you know, I'm proud of that book for a lot of reasons. It is the definitive history of the death penalty in Ohio. I go all the way back to 1702 before the state was even a state. And I talk about how people were executed, different ways the capital punishment evolved in the state. And then I included a lot of my analysis, a lot of my reporting, interviews with death inmates, what it's like to witness an execution, witness the execution. And so that was, you know, a very, it's kind of hard to believe that book's 10 years old, but certainly that had a big impact on me. And frankly, that helped me get into fiction writing, since that publisher had a lot of confidence in proposed, you know, doing something in fiction.
And not to be a total man living under a rock, but what has happened with the death penalty law in Ohio?
Yeah. Oh, no, not at all. It's so Ohio does still have the death penalty, but like a lot of states, it's been almost impossible to find injection. Starting in around 2011, for a bunch of reasons, drug manufacturers finally, under pressure, finally stopped making their drugs available for the purpose of execution. So keep in mind, there's no such thing as a just execution drug, drugs that are used for perfectly legitimate medical reasons, but when they're used in another way, they can put people to death.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of long and complicated history, but the point we're at right now in Ohio is that we have a death penalty.
People are sitting on death row.
Yeah, we have, I think, around 130 guys on death row, one woman. There might be 2 to 3 death sentences, but the state has no lethal injection drugs at the moment. It cannot find them. The governor is not interested in carrying out executions until they have a supply of drugs that would constitutional muster.
And that is also, that is that it doesn't inflict undue pain, right, and suffering, right?
Pain and suffering. And but we Ohio isn't even at that point now. Governor Mike DeWine has also said repeatedly that he, you know, many drug companies have taken the stand now that should one of their drugs somehow end up in state control, that they might cut off the supply of drugs to the state used for other reasons. And Ohio is a huge purchaser of drugs for like psychiatric hospitals.
Okay.
And also just drugs. I mean, we have a way too big prison population. Mates are take drugs, illegal drugs, just like everybody else. And governor doesn't want to run the risk that, you know, a drug company would cut that supply off. So basically what we have in Ohio right now is called a de facto.
Okay.
And I don't anticipate any executions. Oh gosh, for quite a while. And in fact, just on Friday, the governor issued a warrant of reprieve for a guy who was scheduled for execution for February, and he put it off for a year. But that's almost just like a paperwork thing. That's just that was his way of saying we have no drugs and his execution soon.
Now, just out of curiosity, because you did all the data crunching on this. During this de facto moratorium, did evidence come out that some of these alleged killers and now people that were found guilty or pled, like they can't plead to a capital case, that was insane, they found guilty on a capital case, that they were then later exonerated by DNA or other evidence?
Yes, we have had, Ohio has not had the volume of exonerations based on horrible prosecution, horrible defense arguments that places, especially places like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there have been a series of them. There were three kids, basically 18 and 19.
Yeah, I know, kids.
Kids who were convicted of killing a shop owner in Cleveland in the 70s based 100% on the evidence of a 12-year-old kid claimed he saw them drive by in a car. They were sentenced to death, and then in 1978, the law they were sentenced under was thrown out by the U.S. Supreme Court, and so they were then reverted to the general population. But you know, long story short, a crusading reporter named Kyle Swenson, who worked at the time at Cleveland Scene Magazine, took on this case in early 2010s, whatever we call that decade, and eventually the 12-year-old, now a grown man,
yep,
recanted, and one of those guys was actually out of prison by this time. But eventually, the other two were released. They were exonerated. They've been paid millions. And there's a few other cases like that in Ohio where, especially in the pre-DNA days. But also, I have to say, you know, under the current law, which was enacted in 1901, and never been successfully challenged. You know, the 80s and the 90s were just the Wild West when it came to capital punishment in Ohio. Defense attorneys were horrible. Prosecutors were relentless. People didn't really, you know, there were just so many things wrong with the law at the time. And by the way, that was not a knock on the defense bar in general. Plenty of defense attorneys now agree that some of the early defense attorneys, they weren't properly trained.
Right.
And, you know, now you have to be a capital punishment certified defense attorney every death penalty defendant gets 2 attorneys. So it's much more, if you're going to have the death penalty, you have the process in place now to work the way it should. But some of those cases from the in the 80s and 90s. And just guys ended up on death row that frankly should never have been there.
Yeah.
Some of them were executed.
Yeah. And and there's no do-overs.
The death penalty is a final revocation of life that just makes it really different than the other criminal charge.
It's true. I know it's not usually a conversation that I have with my crime writers. I usually save that for I'm working with private investigators, but you wear the hat of an investigative journalist. So if I missed that, if I passed up on this opportunity to talk to you about your nonfiction, shame on me. So I wanted to bring that up too. I thought that was something that we should have the listeners know about. You know, you also can write that as well and use it from your research that you did as a journalist.
Yeah.
So besides some of the names you've already given us of some of the earlier influences on your world of crime fiction writing, there are some other people that you like that you would want to share with my listeners, as maybe if they're between books, they might want to pick up some of the backlist from some of these people. So please go ahead.
Yeah. I read very widely. I read a lot of mystery fiction. I read a lot of nonfiction, science fiction. I'm in a book club and I read wonderful books that have nothing to do with crime. But this is a little arbitrary, but there are four authors whose most recent book I always try to read. And they are Laura Lippman, who I consider, frankly, just one of the best American novelists, period.
Mm-hmm.
I really, I got to know her through her Tess Monahan Private Eye series. And now she has some standalone books that are just outstanding. I'm a big fan of Michael Connelly, his Harry Bosch series. But more recently, he's introduced, because frankly, he's aging Bosch in real time, and Bosch is getting up. So
he was a Vietnam vet.
Right.
That puts him around 75 years old now at this point.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And if you pay attention, if you watch the TV, Amazon Bosch show, he was in that show, he's a first Gulf. They played with that. But Connelly has introduced this dynamic character, Renee Ballard, who's a homicide shift. And I just think she's just fantastic. Hope to see more of her.
And they teamed her up with Bosch.
Yes, I think what he's doing now is Bosch is now sort of working with her as a kind of off the books private investigator. It's kind of, I think it's his way of keeping Bosch in the picture, teaming on with Ballard. Karen Slaughter, the Atlanta novelist, love her. She's got a Will Trent, the Will Trent series. He's a Georgia Bureau of Investigation agent. And I really like him as a character. Her standalone books are just so deliciously dark. I just really enjoy those. And then the other person is Lee Child. Love Jack Reacher. Read quite a lot of those. Of those that come out. I loved a book I really can't recommend enough is his short story collection. That came out a couple of years ago, which just the collected Jack Reacher stories. And I thought those were fantastic. So, that's a really, that is a little bit arbitrary. I do read, lots of writers. I like Elifer Burke, her books. Her father, of course, is James Lee Burke. I've read a lot of his.
David Robichaud.
Exactly. A writer that is, unfortunately, deceased, but was a huge influence on me, was Stuart Kaminsky. And I don't know if his name is familiar to a lot of people, although he wrote so many books. He wrote four different series, including a Moscow police detective, a great series involving a private eye named Toby Pierce, where they're all set in 1940s Hollywood, and there's a lot of real Hollywood actors show up. He wrote a really entertaining series about a pair of Chicago police detectives. And then possibly my favorite books he wrote were about a Sarasota, Florida process server named Lou Finesca. He's this sort of down in the dumps guy, kind of a sad sack. His wife was killed in a drunk driving accident in Chicago, and he fled the city and shows up in Sarasota. that I think there's six books in that series, and there's very much an arc from the. But he's someone that that I really like a lot. I miss his writing. Miss him around.
Well, with all the people that you've mentioned, and him included, there's enough reading there that keep a crime fiction crime reader busy for months. Yeah,
I hope so. Yeah, it's
if you could find them all on Kindle Unlimited, well, even better.
Yeah, it's we really are in a it's a cliche, but I'll say we're in a platinum age of crime writing, not just in terms of the number of books that are being published, but quality, the number of voices, just there's so many fantastic books out there. And the one thing I will say is we're long past, one thing that drives me crazy is this upturned sniff of the nose. Oh, you write genre fiction.
Mm.
I mean, putting my own books aside, some of the best books, I mean, I'll just go with Laura Lippman. You know, Laura Lippman is writing some of the best novels, period.
Right.
And you can say that about so many crime writers, frankly, so many science fiction writers. We're at a point now where this is the best fiction, period, that's being written. And if you're just, you know, if you're taking the attitude of, well, I only read literary fiction, I think you're just missing some of the best writing out there.
Oh, yeah. 70 years ago, Raymond Chandler threw it right back at him, as did Dashiell Hammett. He showed that they both, pound for pound, showed them how they could write hard-boiled detectives, but do it in a literary fashion that would make some other literary writers back in the day weep. You know, that's how good they were. So, absolutely. Now, let me tell you, when you have I can't disagree with you one bit about Laura Lippman, especially with the Tess Monahan series. Really, you know, well-written stuff. And you look at the way they're crafted, put that up against some hoity-toity writers, and I'll tell you, I'll do the blind taste test. You know?
Yeah,
for sure. Now, interesting. We talk about that, and there's a writer that doesn't get enough credit for what they did, but I'm a fan of Robert Galbraith. Now, that's a name that is a pseudonym for somebody that you might know by the name of J.K. Rowling, and just found that I never read a Harry Potter book in my life. I saw it on TV once in a while. I never went to the movies to see it, any of the Harry Potter stuff. But when she came out with Robert Galbraith writing the Cormoran Strike series, I thought this was just fantastic writing. And for her to go so much against stereo, to have a franchise like she did with this Harry Potter series, and then to write under that pseudonym to follow four book series. And these aren't small books. These go at least 100,000 each. At least they feel that way. That did such a fantastic job. And there you are, somebody crossing genres and doing it brilliantly. Yeah. So I don't find crime fiction writing to be anything less or anything more. I just know that when I'm sitting there at 1 o'clock in the morning on a weeknight and I'm cursing because I have to still go to bed and get up and work the next day, and I can't because I have to get to the end, then I know I've got a good book in my hands. So, and I don't know too many literary fiction books that will have me up at 1 o'clock in the morning with bated breath waiting for the finish, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. You know, I couldn't agree with you more. I will say I think I have read every word.
Oh.
And I agree with you completely. Those former and Strike, Robin Ellicott, that team that she's created in this Private Eye series is iconic, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And they
really play well against each other, and the way their arc gone. Oh, my. And yeah, I can't wait for the next one.
Yeah. My only worry is that the fourth one was pretty long. This is one criticism that has followed her in her is that she does write long, and I would hope that she sometimes you need to rein in it a little bit.
Okay.
I think that you know, we're talking about backstory. Her Private Eye is an Afghan, was a British military police investigator.
I believe. Right.
Lost part of a foot or of a leg
up to his knee.
Yeah, in Afghanistan. And you know, what I said earlier is I didn't have the confidence or the I just didn't feel that's going to pull off. And I think she pulled it off 100%.
Oh yeah,
research.
Oh yeah. Oh, for real, no doubt. So we by fiat we mentioned another one, but only because we got talking about the hoity-toity nose up in the air people. You know, I belonged to a writer group for a short period of time. It's the reason why it was a very short period of time. And when I came in there with my crime thriller writing, you thought that I was a knuckle dragger coming in from, you know, tuning somebody up. It's just,
yeah,
it's unfortunate. Okay, I'm sorry. The poets and the real prose people, they just sort of, you know. And I was like, okay, I'm sorry, guys. It's your loss. But anyhow, so Andrew, it's been a pleasure. Look how fast this time has gone.
Yeah.
Oh my. And then
good conversation.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you came on the show. I'm glad that you had a chance to really go do a deep dive on Andy. Love your, the people that you like to read, as I do. Many of them overlap, but how can people get in touch with you and how can people find your books? Because that's the opportunity now to learn a little bit more about Andy Hayes.
Yeah. So, I guess I'll start by recommending my website, andrewwelshhuggins.com.
Mm-hmm.
Information on all the books is there, as well as information about upcoming events and some of my journalism and all that kind of good stuff. I'll put a shout out for my newsletter, which is a very low impact newsletter. I am not a buy my book person in
right.
my newsletter. I include a lot of books that I've read. A lot of reading recommendations, a lot of my favorite bookstores and libraries, and that. So, people are interested in that.
I think everybody should have a well curated newsletter. And it sounds like that's what you are.
Yeah, it's. I enjoy doing it. I'm on Twitter at AWH Columbus, which is also my Instagram handle. And my Instagram, I post four things on Instagram, which are the four most important things. I think post. Whichever book I've just finished with a little quote from whatever book it is.
Mm-hmm.
I put pictures of libraries I've been to, bookstores. And then my wife and I are in a continual quest for the greatest fried bologna sandwich. So you will see some fried bologna sandwich.
Fried bologna sandwich. Now, is this something that is like a regional delicacy? Columbus, or where did you pick this habit up?
No, it's there's a very famous restaurant called the GNR Tavern, a little town called Waldo, Ohio. Which, they're claiming it's justified. They claim they have the greatest fried bologna sandwich in head, and it's good. But you can actually, there's a lot of places with fried bologna sandwiches around the country. So there's a ton of them in Ohio, but there's Pam and I have had them multiple other places. So.
Mm.
And you know, it's not a sandwich you want to have more than about once a month.
And your cardiologist recommends less
exactly.
than that. But
yeah, it's good occasion.
Well, I grew up, or I was born in Troy, New York, and they call it the capital city region. In and around Albany, Troy, Cohoes, and Watervliet, they have what is called fish fries, and these are restaurants that I guess in the cater to the heavy or predominantly Catholic population that never ate meat on Fridays. And they also added other things to their menu, but they do fish fries. And it's a foot, maybe 14 inch long piece of white fish that is flash fried, put into a bun that if it's not in a cardboard boat, bun might, you know, you might not know the difference between the cardboard boat or the bun, but it's not about the bun. It's about the fish. And that's a delicacy that is just pretty much within the confines of the capital city region. And every time I go back, visit family or, you know, and it's coming more and more for funerals and for baptisms, I always make sure to get one or two. So, yeah, I know what you mean. So
sounds wonderful.
Search for the quest of the fried bologna sandwich. That's something I'm going to have to look at on a menu because I don't travel the country a lot. But when I do, I'll go into a restaurant and I'll ask, what do you do here that you don't do anywhere else? And one of these days, they're going to tell me about a fried bologna sandwich. And I'm going to say, well, I know a guy. He told me about fried bologna once and I have to try it. So
The question is, do you wash those fish sandwiches down with Utica Club?
No.
You have to draw a line someplace.
Yes. Utica Club. Oh, my God. Now, I recall it. So, anyhow. Andrew, thank you so much for being on.
Thanks, John. Pleasure being with you.
Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. My guest next week is Michael Julian. Mike is the CEO and president of MPS Security and Protection, a division of National Business Investigations, Inc., founded in 1967 by his father, Ron Julian. The company provides corporate executive protection, threat and risk mitigation, and security. Michael is licensed in multiple states as a private investigator and security professional. He is a graduate of the Executive Protection Institute and the Executive Security International. He's also a board director or member of several national and international industry associations. His security training includes behavioral threat assessment, active shooter survival, executive and asset protection, self-defense, defensive and evasive driving, close protection, aviation security, protective surveillance, counter-surveillance, and covert detection. Besides active shooter, he frequently teaches training courses in executive and asset protection. In 2014, Michael created the ALIVE Active Shooter Survival Training Program and began teaching his active shooter survival philosophy throughout the United States. His book on the subject, 10 Minutes to Live, Using ALIVE to Survive an Active Shooter, was published in 2017. In 2019, the long-awaited online version, the ALIVE training program, was launched and is now part of the corporate employee security training program for companies throughout the world. In mid-2019, the first ALIVE instructor certification course was held at the ALIVE corporate headquarters in Southern California, creating several new qualified instructors to present the program. Michael is now a keynote speaker at conferences, but still teaches the course to select businesses, public utility agencies, medical and educational institutions throughout the world. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear other great detective stories, please go to the website and click on our podcast page. There you'll find the backlist. Now, you're probably asking, John, what about your own stories? Do you have any? Sure enough, I do. And they are available to you free as a download right to your inbox. I have 8 short stories and 8 vignettes in a book titled Mugshots, My Favorite Detective Stories. Now, here's my ask. If you were either informed, inspired, or entertained by the stories today, don't be bashful. Share this link with your friends. Better still, go to the iTunes website and leave a review. It's the best way to grow the circle around our campaign. If you have any questions, please contact me through the website, www.johnhoda.com, J-O-H-N-H-O-D-A.com. Thanks so much, and have a great day.